sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you're going to hear an interview with James Douglas, author of the book JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. James Douglas will be on a speaking tour of New England beginning September 30th, with a stop here at Central Connecticut State University in New Britain on Monday, October 4th. It'll take place in Vance Hall, room 105, at 7 p.m. The book JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters, was first released in 2008. The paperback will be coming out on October 19th, but I understand that there will be advanced copies available at the event on October 4th. So, James Douglas, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Would you tell us a bit about yourself and what motivated you to write the book JFK and the Unspeakable?
Shelley, my wife and I have a Catholic worker house here in Birmingham, Alabama. We've worked in peace and justice for the 40 years of our marriage, and independently before that, we've done work especially in the anti-nuclear movement and resistance to the Vietnam War. And more recently, in Birmingham, we've worked a lot on the death penalty and, in my own case, especially on the assassinations of Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and John and Robert Kennedy. How I got started in it was through Dr. King's assassination. I was teaching at the University of Hawaii when he was murdered in April of 1968, and students there who were in a course I was teaching on the theology of peace began what they called the Hawaii Resistance. They burned their draft cards. They went to jail for periods ranging from 6 months to 2 years. And I went to jail also for blocking a troop convoy with them. And all of our lives changed. It was a baptism into nonviolence through Dr. King's gift of his life and taking of it by what we felt was a larger reality than the one lone assassin who was arrested and put in jail. So for many years, I tried to understand Dr. King's assassination, and in the 90s, attended a trial for that purpose. It was a wrongful death lawsuit filed by the King family, and it was found that Dr. King was killed by a government conspiracy, a fact that is known very little by the people of this country. But then, by analogy, I became very much questioning person in regard to the other key assassinations of the 60s and began to explore and write on them. And now I'm writing on all of them, but chronologically, the first is John F. Kennedy, and that's why I've written about him first.
I read Dr. Pepper's book about the Martin Luther King trial, and yes. I was astounded that I just read it like maybe 2 years ago, and I was astounded that I had never heard of that, all of that before. It was just amazing that that could all happen and the media never covered it.
It is amazing, but not so amazing when we begin to get into the questions of all four of them, and we begin to understand a little bit more what Thomas Merton called the unspeakable, where we don't want to go, where the media don't want to go, where none of us really want to go, because it involves a kind of systemic evil, a kind of darkness that is quite intimidating and which involves questions that we would rather not explore.
Okay, well, hopefully we'll develop some of that here. I did want to ask you, starting sort of from the beginning, in the book you discuss the turn of JFK toward peace as opposed to the Cold War mentality. Can you elaborate on that and connect that to why you think he died?
John Kennedy was indeed a cold warrior, but in the course of the first spring of his presidency, he encountered all kinds of realities that raised questions for him that went beyond his assumptions. The first came up in regard to the Bay of Pigs invasion that the Central Intelligence Agency had already been planning through the previous administration, Eisenhower's. And Kennedy felt that the CIA manipulated him and lied to him and set him up in the Bay of Pigs when the Cuban exiles that they had trained were trying to land at a place called the Bay of Pigs. And they told him that there would be a cover for the exiles to go into terrain where they could hide and things of that nature. And they gave him information, false information, about an uprising that would occur among the Cuban people. And the whole situation was set up in such a way that the only way that he could be expected to act would be to call in U.S. troops, because otherwise it was a certain loss for the United States forces, well, for the Cuban exiles, unless U.S. forces were called in. And he said in advance he would never do that, and he held to that line, and he refused to do it, even though he realized in the course of the situation that he had been set up and lied to. So after it was all over, he said, "I want to splinter the CIA in 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds." He was furious, and he ordered an investigation into the whole thing under the jurisdiction and very searching eyes of his brother, his Attorney General brother, Robert Kennedy. And from that point on, Kennedy was basically at odds with his national security state, represented by the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who had also deceived him, and the CIA. And in the Cuban Missile Crisis, it became a much deeper conflict. And at that point, he turned toward his enemy, Nikita Khrushchev, with whom he had already been secretly corresponding, and sought a way out that was considered treason by his national security state. So he was turning in the course of those months, and not in the direction of his advisors, but in the direction of actually the enemy, realizing that he had more in common with Nikita Khrushchev, because they were both trying to avoid nuclear war, than he had with his own national security state. And he realized the same was true of Khrushchev, that Khrushchev had more in common with Kennedy than he had with his Soviet advisors. So the two of them began to become secret allies, and that was the beginning of the end of the life of John F. Kennedy.
So you're saying that the CIA, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, this national security state, were committing treasonous acts and trying to force the president to do things that he didn't want to do. In a sense, they were in charge and he wasn't, or that's what they were hoping for?
That's true. But from their standpoint, he was committing treason. They had very different viewpoints. He was trying to be president of the United States. They were thinking that he, like his predecessor, Dwight D. Eisenhower, should do what they wanted him to do. Eisenhower had followed the wishes of not only Allen Dulles, but of his brother John Foster Dulles. The two Dulles brothers basically ran the Eisenhower foreign policy in that administration. But John Kennedy would not do what his advisors told him, and he felt that it was indeed treason to be trying to work toward a nuclear war, and a first-strike nuclear war was what the CIA and the Joint Chiefs were calling for. They wanted to, quote, win, unquote, the Cold War by attacking the Soviet Union and causing 150 million casualties with, as they put it, only 20 or 30 million on our side, thereby winning the Cold War. He thought that was insanity. He walked out of meetings with them. He expressed his resistance to it in a variety of ways, and they thought this man had to go. And from the Cuban Missile Crisis on, he was turning in a different direction. He gave a great speech called the American University Address on June 10, 1963, where he called for an end of the Cold War and sought to initiate the process by a nuclear test ban treaty. He unilaterally said he wouldn't test nuclear weapons in the atmosphere unless somebody else did it first. And he then negotiated very quickly in 6 weeks with Nikita Khrushchev the partial nuclear test ban treaty. And from that point on, step by step, he was moving simultaneously toward a disarmed vision and his own execution in Dallas.
So the national security state was having problems with him. Where does Lee Harvey Oswald fit into this? And according to your research, how did the president die?
Lee Harvey Oswald was an operative for the CIA. He had been a top secret radar operator at Atsugi Air Force Base in Japan in the 1950s. And from that point on, he was under the control of the CIA. He was a false defector after a fake discharge from the Marines. He went to the Soviet Union, said that he was going to turn over all the information he had learned in the Marines, which of course included his information that he received as a U-2 radar operator. That was the most secret project that the CIA had in those years, high flights over the Soviet Union and China and other countries to map the terrain and to spy on those countries. And Oswald said, well, I'm going to turn all that information over to the Russians, and I renounce my commitment to the United States. And he then stayed in the, he said that to the U.S. Embassy in Moscow. And then he went on and lived in the Soviet Union for a couple of years, married a Russian woman, and then decided, oh, I'm going to come back to the United States, and was given financial aid by the same embassy to do so. They didn't prosecute him. I mean, they didn't turn over the information for his prosecution in the U.S., and very mysteriously, he's welcomed back into the country. Well, that was because he was working with the CIA, and then he settled in Dallas and was under the control of CIA operatives such as George DeMorenshield at the instruction of the CIA office there in Dallas. So Oswald was being set up during those days. He was impersonated in Mexico City by a man who said he was Lee Harvey Oswald and who was making all kinds of phone calls and visits to the Soviet and Cuban consulates to involve Oswald in a visible way with a plot involving the Cuban and a seeming plot to involve the Cuban and Soviet representatives, so that when he was then in Dallas and being again misrepresented in various ways and as by various imposters at rifle ranges and doing actions that intimated that he was preparing for an assassination, he was being led into a situation where he would then be arrested on the day of the assassination for murdering JFK. And he was part of the plot. He was a person who was involved in the plot, but I'm sure he didn't think that he was going to be indicted as the lone assassin. And I think instead, and there's a considerable amount of evidence for this, that he was trying to stop the plot, a plot that actually included another patsy in Chicago. So there was a plot to kill Kennedy in Chicago, just as there was in Dallas. And a man named Thomas Arthur Valley was the Oswald in the Chicago plot. There are all kinds of steps in the plot to kill Kennedy, and Oswald was being set up point by point to the point where he was arrested in Dallas.
So, and you're saying that it was basically the CIA was behind his death then?
Well, the CIA coordinated the assassination, but it was much larger than the CIA. The Secret Service was involved. All the Joint Chiefs of Staff were involved, but the CIA coordinated it, and they had people impersonating Oswald, and they had a second Oswald in Dallas on that day. So Oswald was being set up the same time as he was thinking that he was stopping the plot. And I think he did succeed in stopping the plot in Chicago, where there was an identical situation where a motorcade with John F. Kennedy in it was scheduled to go under the window of a man who had a very similar background to Oswald, who was also a Marine, also at a CIA base in Japan with very, very similar kind of background, and who then was working in an office building with a window right above the motorcade. So he too would have been the scapegoat had the Chicago plot worked 20 days before the one in Dallas. And there was also a sniper team where two people were arrested and then released by the Secret Service rather than indicted and rather than identified. So the plot was allowed to proceed until it succeeded in Dallas. It didn't succeed in Chicago because Kennedy canceled his trip there at the very last possible moment.
Wow, I'd never heard that part of the Chicago piece.
The Chicago plot is really the window into the Dallas plot, and that's thanks to a very courageous Secret Service agent, the first African-American in the Secret Service, a man named Abraham Bolden, who blew the whistle on the Chicago plot and who tried to do so to the Warren Commission. And because he had the courage to try to do that, he was immediately set up himself on trumped-up charges that he had conveyed information, Secret Service information, to a counterfeiter, and he was recalled from Washington when he was trying to reach the Warren Commission and put in prison. And he was in prison for 3.5 years and almost died in prison if it hadn't been for the courage of his wife in supporting him and in getting legal help for him. He would have been killed in prison. Because of Abraham Bolden, we know the nature of the Chicago plot, and because of an investigative reporter and a number of people have looked into it by now, we know how Kennedy would have been killed in Chicago in the same way that he was, in fact, killed in Dallas. All the key details of the plot are exactly the same from Chicago to Dallas.
So now, this was over 40 years ago.
Yes.
Why does it matter today?
It matters today because it's all happening all over again. Well, it's been happening ever since then. That, of course, was a lead-in to other key events that turned this country around, the assassination of Malcolm X, and we were already talking about Dr. King, and then Robert Kennedy, who would have become President of the United States in all likelihood had he not been assassinated as soon as he turned that corner by winning the California primary on June 4, 1968, and that was just a couple months after King's assassination. So it mattered right through those days because the success, as seen from the standpoint of the plotters and from the national security state, the success of their being able to kill Kennedy and to cover it up successfully gave them the confidence and gave successors the confidence to carry out those others and a series of events since then. But today, here we are with Afghanistan, analogous to Vietnam, and Kennedy, in a step that I haven't even mentioned yet, he issued a national security memorandum, NSAM 263, to withdraw from Vietnam 1 month before his assassination. So he was refusing to cooperate with his national security state, which was trying to trap him from one point to another, from the Bay of Pigs to Vietnam, and, of course, the Cuban Missile Crisis in the middle. President Obama is in the same situation, as has been every president, for that matter, with his national security state. In Afghanistan, he's been trapped. He was set up by, not so much by McChrystal, who is simply the front man, as by General Petraeus, by their issuing intimations and basically orders to the president, you got to escalate in Afghanistan because that's what we're telling you to do. That's insubordination. And I don't mean primarily the more recent interview by McChrystal. I mean a whole year ago when it was more Petraeus, with McChrystal simply being his man out front, setting up Obama in that way. And to his credit, Obama hesitated before taking the step, but he did take the step, as Kennedy refused to do, of going for it in Afghanistan. He's in the same situation that Kennedy was, for that matter, right back to Eisenhower, who was warning about it as the military-industrial complex's power over the presidency. It matters because it's happening right now. It continues to happen with every president, and unless the president does what he or she is told, he faces or she faces severe consequences, just as Kennedy did. But for that matter, the question is to each of us, are we going to go along with it? Are we going to be silent, or are we going to resist all of this in the way that Dr. King did?
And do you see the 9/11 attacks and cover-up. Do you see them as part of the same thing? We're sort of now held hostage as a nation by this endless war on terror.
It's a very strong analogy to the Kennedy assassination. If you can get away with killing the President of the United States, you begin to think you can do anything. And that's, if you take a close look at 9/11, as you have done, I know, and as my friend David Ray Griffin in his books, you just are overwhelmed by the audacity of the lies. And that's the same thing coming down as in the Kennedy assassination. And the audacity of the action itself to shoot the President of the United States in daylight, basically, you know, 12:30 p.m. in a motorcade through Dallas by sniper fire from several points, so blatantly to do that and then to so absurdly cover it up, you've got the same kind of thing going on in 9/11. And Griffin has exposed it in his works. And I think the one that's most significant is he calls it the mysterious collapse of World Trade Center 7. And I think if one looks especially into the third building that went down and examines the extraordinary, to put it mildly, explanations that are offered by the government, you feel a very deep darkness there, and it goes into our own psyche and into our own complicity.
Right. I mean, it is very frightening if you read about the Martin Luther King assassination and how it involved the CIA, the FBI,
yes,
the local police, and local business. I mean,
yes,
it's pretty scary. And from what you're saying, the JFK assassination had similar players at the national level.
The Kennedy assassination is, in my opinion, even worse because, first of all, because it's prior in time, and it makes possible Dr. King's assassination. If we had dealt as a nation, as a people, with the Kennedy assassination, Dr. King would not have been assassinated. And also, with King, I can understand better from the standpoint of the person, the courage and the depth of resistance to the government. I mean, Dr. King was profoundly committed to nonviolence. Now, that's not the case for John Kennedy. He's the President of the United States. He's in the center of the national security state. So I found it quite remarkable that a person in that position was willing to go to the point that he did, to his own death. And he was not naive. He knew where it was going to end up. And the thing that, I guess, offered some explanation for that to me was his living with death. The man was not afraid to die. And he was so frequently under that raven on his shoulder. He was so frequently in the situation of dying, whether it was in war or as a child under various illnesses, or for that matter, even in the presidency, he was profoundly in pain virtually all the time because of his back and illnesses that he had. And through all of that, he developed an attitude toward death that was expressed in prayers that he said that we have, is expressed in his favorite poem called I Have a Rendezvous with Death, is expressed in all kinds of ways in conversations with friends and his loved ones. And that's, I think, what gave him the freedom to resist his national security state and gave him the freedom to risk his own life and to have it taken from him.
We're almost out of time, but I had one last question for you. What do you suggest we do to resist this deeper state or secret state that seems to be controlling our world?
I would say that the most important thing to do is to get together in a community with other people who are willing to ask the most profound questions of responsibility in each of our lives. And that means being willing to risk the kind of things in our own lives to get at the truth and to live out the truth in the way that Gandhi spoke of and the way that King spoke of and the way that all of these people that we're talking about spoke of and lived it out. And then to go for it, whether it involves risking a job by acting out the truth in it or whether it involves nonviolent civil disobedience through resisting taxes instead of paying for the killing of thousands of people in the various wars that we carry out. There are all kinds of ways that one can take steps into the truth. And I think if you get together with a little community of friends and begin to explore the truth of each of these issues, whether you begin with the JFK assassination or 9/11 or something more immediate in your own community, you'll be getting into the unspeakable very quickly. We're in very deep water right now, all of us, and unless we have the courage to go where we haven't wanted to go, we're going to be taken to places that are much worse than anything we've faced up to now.
James Douglas, thank you for writing this fascinating and disturbing book. It's been a real pleasure to have you on the show today, and I look forward to meeting you on October 4th at the event at Central Connecticut State University.
Thank you.
You can hear and see James Douglas speaking about his book, JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters, on Monday, October 4th at 7 p.m. at Central Connecticut State University in New Britain. He'll be on the campus in Vance Hall, room 105. For more information, you can call 860-930-3182. That's 860-930-3182. The title of his speech is JFK, Obama, and the Unspeakable, A Parable of Turning. Advanced copies of the paperback edition, which will be released on October 19th, will be available at the October 4th event at CCSU. And Jim also mentioned that they'll be available at a significantly reduced price from what you'll pay in the bookstore when they come out on October 19th. Here's what Daniel Ellsberg, author of the Pentagon Papers, has to say about Douglas's book, JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. Douglas presents brilliantly an unfamiliar yet thoroughly convincing account of a series of creditable decisions by John F. Kennedy, at odds with his initial Cold War stance, that earned him the secret distrust and hatred of hardliners among the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the CIA. Did this suspicion and rage lead directly to his murder by agents of these institutions, as Douglas concludes? Many readers who are not yet convinced of this beyond reasonable doubt by Douglas's prosecutorial indictment will find themselves perhaps, like myself for the first time, compelled to call for an authoritative criminal investigation. Recent events give all the more urgency to learning what such an inquiry can teach us about how, by whom, and in whose interests this country is run. And here's what Richard Falk, a Milbank professor of international law emeritus from Princeton University, has to say about the book. A remarkable book, devastating in its documented indictment of the dark forces that have long deformed the public life of this country, while also illuminating JFK's final vision of world peace and documenting beyond reasonable doubt the unspeakable assassination of our last partially admirable president. This book should be required reading for every American citizen. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.